This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studios in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy I have in the studio with me a wonderful author, and he was here before, and I was thinking about who I wanted to talk to during Black History Month, and there's a few people that he talks about in his book that I thought, well, I need to have Rick Rhodes back here. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Patsy. Good to be back with you.
Okay. Well, you wrote a book called They Made America Great, 31 Endearing Legacies Worth Heeding Today. And it is a book that I go back to every once in a while. I keep it around the house near my reading chair, because the people that you mention in there are you know, important to American history, and you come across their names every once in a while. And when my son was here, I mentioned to you before the program that he and his friends, they love trivia. And so when he saw this book, he started looking at it. He said, well, I didn't know all these stories. And then he looks at me sort of, Mom, you were my homeschool mom. You didn't teach me all of these people, although he knew most of them. But there were a few that, you know, he didn't know. And as a matter of fact, when I first got the book, there were a few that I didn't know. And so I really just love it. And, you know, there's, of course, you cover many people like Ben Franklin that people know, and Davy Crockett and John Quincy Adams. But some of the other people that you cover, people just generally don't know about or don't know enough about. And so which two did you select to talk to today?
Well, Black History Month, there's two that people should know about, Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. And there's several other black folks in my book.
But I think let's stick with these two, because these are so important. And as it is Black History Month. And I want to say, somebody asked me, like, this month, do I have any black authors on, and I said no. As a matter of fact, I sort of think it's, I don't want, I've had black authors on, and I love so many of their books, and I want them to feel that they're year-round people. I mean, they're not just February. It's not right. One of the agents that I've had on, a lovely black woman named Regina Brooks, I just love her. And she's so enthusiastic always about her authors. And we're going to schedule throughout the year her authors, because she just has a wonderful selection of authors from fiction, nonfiction, and children's books. So but it's important that we talk about Black history this month, and I think the two that you've selected are just perfect.
I totally agree with you, Patsy. And, you know, Black history is American history, American history that we should be very proud of as white people. Absolutely. And black people.
So who do you want to start with, Harriet?
I'll start with Harriet. Sure, okay. Everybody should
amazing,
know Harriet.
Isn't
yeah.
she?
Well, she was born, I'm talking about Harriet and Frederick, they were born almost close together, within 20 miles apart on the eastern shore of Maryland. Harriet was born in Dorchester County, which is Cambridge, Maryland, and Frederick was born in Talbot County, I think Easton, Maryland, or something like that, an area I'm familiar with as a child. But Harriet, she was, when you look at her, you'd say, this girl's not going to amount to much. She's short, she's sickly, she couldn't read or write, unlike Frederick Douglass. Interesting story, when she was a young girl, she was supposed to basically take care of a little white baby, and if the baby cried, she was whipped. One time she was whipped 5 times before breakfast, and she still had those scars the rest of her life. She was very close to her parents. Another interesting story, in Cambridge, Maryland, she was talking to a slave who was basically off work. He wasn't supposed to be off work, and his overseer came into a dry goods store and saw him and threw a lead weight at this man who was not where he was supposed to be, toiling in the fields, and his shot was bad. He hit Harriet in the head and almost killed her. She was out for 2 days, got migraine headaches the rest of her life, and as soon as she could, she went back to the field. And this affected her the rest of her life. She had some type of global epilepsy for this her life, and she thought she was getting messages from God, and God knows, maybe she was. But she wasn't amount to be much. And finally, she had a big family. She was heartbroken every time one of her brothers and sisters were sold off, as they were. And the first time she tried to escape, it was with two of her brothers. And I know the Eastern Shore of Maryland's kind of got swamps and stuff like that. And they were out for 2 or 3 days. And it was nasty, cold, wet. And the brothers, I think Ben and the other one, got cold feet and wanted to go back. And Harry said, "Why are you guys going back?" And they went back, took a whipping. At least we'll be fed back at the plantation. And they went all back, and they got whipped. And less than a year later, I believe, Harriet went out on her own. Now, she's married to a man, a free black man at the time, named John Tubman. And Harriet goes out on her own. And there's a network of Underground Railroad people there, probably spearheaded by the Quakers. Quakers were wonderful people back then. I think they still are. And so she's going out in the swamps of making her way, and she gets all the way to Philadelphia, and she hooks up with the great network up there in Philadelphia. And about a year later, she does some stuff trying to get a niece out of slavery, and then she goes back to get her husband. I think this is a great story. She goes back to get her husband, risking her life, and through all the swamps and the rain and the cold, and she finds him, and he had another woman, and he wouldn't go back. Now, what does she do? She thought the guy was a, you know what, but she picks herself up and says, "Who the hell else wants to get out of here tonight?" 13 hands went up, 11 or 13, that's not sure the right number. And that was the beginning. She took a setback like that, slapped in the face by her own husband in a figurative sense, and took that and said, "Who wants to get out of here?" And that was the beginning of her great, whatever you want to call it, avocation. She made, you don't know how many people she took on the Underground Railroad. She said, she bragged, she never lost a passenger. I think that is true. But the lowest estimate is 70 and 13 trips. She always went out in the wintertime when it was cold and the white people were inside. But she took that adversity of her husband basically refusing, after she risked her life for this fool, refusing to go back, and said, "Who else wants to get out of here?" And that's picking yourself up by the bootstraps, as far as I'm concerned. Wonderful, wonderful lady. I'm glad she's on a stamp. I'm no comment on the $20 bill, but she's just a great inspiration for all American women, black or white.
Well, explain a little bit more about this trail. How did she do it?
A very good question. The Underground Railroad was no, I remember I give this to kids, they're looking for a railroad under the ground. Of course not. It's a network of people that knew this. Basically, it was as long as slavery existed, but it got very busy about 1900 to about 1800 to 1860, to the Civil War. And it was, some people knew at the time. It's a wonderful group of people that just had safe houses along the way, even into the semi-deep South, mostly led by Quakers, Presbyterians, and Methodists, that said, "This is wrong. I don't care what the Book of Philemon says in the Bible. Slavery is wrong." And these people did things to help people get out. And Harriet became very religious, and she didn't buy that part of the Bible. She couldn't read, but she thought, you know, whipping people and seeing all this was wrong. So people, good people, there's two horrible laws in the United States. You think we have horrible laws ever passed? You're darn tootin'. The first and second Fugitive Slave Act. The second one of 1850 made it, if a Northerner knew of a runaway slave somewhere north of the Mason-Dixon line and didn't report him or turn him in, they could be fined, I think, a year's pay roughly at that time. So, but they were people that were brave enough to do the right thing at that time and go against the grain. And they basically helped these two safe houses, these people, do the Underground Railroad, work their way up the free country, up in Pennsylvania in this particular case, above the Mason-Dixon line. And then Harriet went back, and she went, and she did it. She made many trips afterward, and she became known as Moses to her people.
And she really did risk her life each time.
Every time.
If they had caught her, oh.
Yeah, there was. I don't know what the price on her head was, but there was. They didn't know who she was. They couldn't believe her name was Minty Ross when she was born. They couldn't believe that this little petite woman was the one, was this theoretical or Moses person who's taken all these people out of here, out of the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And then as the war went on, she became a spy for the Union. She knew the swamps well. She did some spy work down in South Carolina, leading, I think, about 700 slaves in the plantations near the end of the Civil War. back out to freedom aboard Union gunships. And then the story, the movie Glory, supposedly she helped that man, I don't know what his name was, but it was Fort Wagner. They attacked. I said, what's his name? Anyway, she gave him his last meal. She was a nurse. She didn't know much about nursing. And she basically helped all these people. And then she asked for a pension. And one of the neatest things about her, I think, she was frail, sickly, and she outlived everybody else, all the other conductors on the Underground Railroad. And when they buried her, when she died, and I think it was 1913, they're not sure when she was born. Some say 1820, some say 1822, anything in between and around that. But when she died, I thought it was so cool. Our country buried her with military honors. That's how far the United States came, you know, in this time. So it's really worthwhile. Really, we have come a long way. We did come a long way. And Harriet Tubman, who basically, you know, was one of the worst, doing some of the roughest stuff in the Underground Railroad, outlived them all. And she was the sickliest one of all. If we're getting close to segueing into Frederick Douglass, I got a great line between Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
For that. After the Civil War, Frederick Douglass, who I'm going to talk about next, was doing all kinds of stuff. He was the spokesman, the conscience of the nation for many people. But Harriet was also somehow on a speaking circuit. She asked Frederick Douglass a comment to say something nice about their relationship. And they did meet in Rochester, New York, where Frederick Douglass had a house and had five of his sons. He had five children, three sons, two daughters. And three of those boys went in the 54th Massachusetts, the all-black unit. He believed in that. But after the war, Harriet said to Douglass, could you make some comment about my things? And this is a quote from Douglass. The difference between us is very marked. Most that I have done and suffered in the service of the cause has been in public. I have wrought in the day, but you, Harriet, in the night. I have had the applause of the crowd, while the most you have done has been witnessed by a few trembling, scared, and sore-footed bondsmen and women. The midnight sky and the silent stars have been the witness to your devotion to freedom and your heroism. I think that says a lot about both of them. I really do. I mean, Douglass was educated. He self-taught himself, and Harriet was illiterate. Harriet, John Brown, as you know, kind of might have been the start of the match that started the Civil War, wanted to basically enlist Harriet. He called her General Tubman at the John Brown's raid. And Harriet, not exactly the most sophisticated person, said, I don't know, John Brown. You want to take Harper's Ferry Arsenal and march down south with people? I might get you. I don't want too much be too much of a part of it, but I might try to get you a few volunteers. And, of course, that raid failed miserably. John Brown, 10 men were lost, including many of John Brown's son. Frederick Douglass, on the other hand, said, John Brown, I admire your willingness to die for the slaves. He said this at his funeral, but I think that's doomed for disaster, and it's going to, you know, really infuriate the South, which it did. And so after that raid happened, I think it was September 1918, I got my centuries mixed up, 1859, Frederick Douglass had to really lay low because he was implicated wrongly as part of that John Brown raid. But are we ready to go into Frederick Douglass?
We have plenty.
Okay, well, what else can I say about Harriet? She's a wonderful woman. She was on a stamp recently. They're talking about putting her on a $20 bill. I have no problem with that. I know we're going to take somebody off. That's always an issue. But anyway, I love Harriet. One of my favorite quotes by Harriet, if you're hungry, keep going. If you're tired, keep going. If you want to taste freedom, keep going. She never gave up. She just had the fortitude and wonderful, just never give up.
So, and she was a little bundle of energy to do all of that. But let's now talk a little bit about Frederick Douglass. Again, just they were born so close to each other. It's amazing.
Yeah, they were born about 20 miles apart on one side of Maryland's Choptank River, two different counties. And I think about 7 years. We're unsure of Harriet's year of birth somewhere, you know. But Frederick Douglass is younger. And he was, you know, his mother worked in the field. He never knew her. And then she died, and his grandmother was getting old, and she died. They put her out into the pasture to die, and he was living there. And he saw white people reading. He said, there's something there. And he was sent to his slave's initial plantation was Talbert County, Maryland. And then he had a overseer friend, I think it was a relative named Uald in Baltimore. And Mrs. Auld was pretty interesting. Frederick was like sitting on her lap, what are you reading? What are you doing? And Mrs. Auld started teaching him how to read and write. And you all, is her husband walked in and said, you can't teach that boy that because they want freedom if they do that. And that was put the kibosh on it. But Frederick knew there was something there in reading and writing. He knew that was the key to sustainable freedom, is being literate. When kids went to school, he asked for their books, and he tried to self-teach himself to read and write. And that was not very, you know, Mr. All did not like it. So he sent Frederick Douglass, a real mean overseer back on the eastern shore of Maryland named Edward Covey. And Covey was known as a slave breaker, a very miserable man. And he beat Frederick for the fun of it. And, you know, he just beat him. And one day Frederick snapped. He put a noose on him. He was beat him bloody. He was just a nasty man. And Frederick fought back. And it was a struggle. And long story short, Frederick got the better of this Edward Covey fellow. And he could have very well been killed for that. But Covey didn't kill him or didn't have him killed. He was scared of him after that. I guess Frederick won. And Frederick said it was the first time in his life he fought back. And he got his dignity back. He said, I was becoming a brute because I was getting beat up and let him beat me up. I'm letting this big, nasty bully. And that nothing more was said. And Frederick, that ember of freedom came back to Frederick. Then he went back to Baltimore to work for you all. But before that, he was teaching other slaves how to read and write in nearby plantations on the southern shore of Maryland, eastern shore of Maryland, in Talbot County and Dorchester County. And his overseer, his master at the time, I wouldn't call it the overseer, said, you know, look the other way. Said, oh, I don't mind. So all the slaves in the plantations were coming to get lessons from Frederick Douglass. And the other plantation owners did not like this one bit. So they went in there and busted the thing up, and they were beating everybody. And that was the end. He was teaching them the Bible. He was teaching them religion. Frederick Douglass, you look at the guy, you say, here's a crazy man. You know, you see a picture of him, his eyes are flaming, his hair is long. And you know what? He never drank, never smoked, never. He believed in, you know, he was a Christian, a very good Christian man at all the same time. He believed in those tenets. And he did not like hypocrisy in religion either. Anyway, he goes back to Baltimore, and he's working for you all now. He's a slave that's rented out. His trade was ship caulking, putting seams in boats and stuff like that. And he got a little bit of that money back, and what did he do? He bought it. He used that money to buy books and learn and read and read and read. He thought his people needed to become educated. Well, there's talk now that he's going to go back to the southern shore of Maryland, the eastern shore of Maryland. And he's met a lady he really loves, Anna Murray. They plan to get married, but you all are sending him back where it's a little harder, much harder to get away and break the freedom in Pennsylvania. And he makes a break for it. So he makes a break on a train, a boat, and he finds his way to New York, and he meets another guy named, I think his name is David Ruggles, last name is Ruggles. He was a black man. He was really big in the Underground Railroad. He was almost blind himself, but he was helping everybody. And he got his wife, Anna, to be, and they got married, and he said, go to New Bedford, Connecticut. New Bedford, you can use your skills as a ship's caulker, and you're pretty far north of slave catchers who were given a green light by the First and Second Fugitive Slave Act to go up there and capture slaves up north. You're pretty well protected in New Bedford, Connecticut. Well, he did, and he sees a newspaper for an anti-slavery meeting headed by William Lloyd Garrison. He goes to it, and Garrison finds out we have a runaway slave in our audience, Frederick Douglass. Let him talk. Frederick Douglass couldn't tell you what he said, but he enthralled the audience. He could make them laugh one second and make them cry the next session. And he was doing really well on the speaking circuit, wrote his first book, and was doing well. And then they were about to catch him. He got beat up. He got his hands broken. And the people, there was a lot of pro-slavery propaganda up north saying how wonderful slavery is for the black man. You know, and Frederick Douglass knew that was all hooey, of course. And he countered that. And he did a lot of good stuff. But they're about to catch him, and he goes to England. And he goes to England, and he's doing this, and people in England were not as prejudiced as they were even in northern United States. They didn't sneer at him, they didn't look down on him, or anything else. And he wanted to bring his family back to England, but he realized there were 4 million slaves in the U.S. South. Where could he do more good? And if he knew if he went back there, he's a high target to be captured and sent to the Deep South. Two of his friends in England said they raised the money, I think it was like $600 or $700, to buy his freedom from you all at this time. And they did. He went back, and he continued on the speaking circuit. And he did all kinds of good stuff. And he became friends with President Lincoln. And he had some great quotes. He has many great quotes. Just Google them. One of my favorite ones, no man can have a chain around another man's ankle without finding the other end fastened to his own neck. And, you know, think about that a little bit. He's absolutely right. And he became the voice. He was educated. He believed in he believed that if you free the black man, you got to have him, you got to educate him, give him everything else so he can compete with the white man and compete in the society of ours. He firmly believed that. A lot of good-meaning white people did not. William Lloyd Garrison thought the U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were evil. Frederick Douglass looked at those documents, a black man, and say, no, they're good documents. We're just not following them as a country. This led a fallout between William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass for the rest of their lives. Although at William Lloyd Garrison's funeral, Frederick Douglass was there and gave him a very respectful last rites commentary. But Frederick went on to become just a wonderful man. He married Anna Murray, stayed married to her. Five of his children, three boys, went and fought in that 54th Massachusetts. You know, and he believed that the black soldiers should get paid as much as the white soldiers. And he was absolutely right. He fought for that with some success.
Well, you know, As I said, I enjoyed this book so much. There is so much information in it. And, Rick, I really want to thank you for this book because it's a very useful book. And I will talk more about it near the end of the program. I'm going to take a commercial break, and then I'm going to come back, and I have a very special guest, Stephen Harrigan, and we're going to be talking about his book, A Friend of Mr. Lincoln, and it sort of blends in with what you've been talking about, and we'll continue talking after the break, okay?
Can't wait to hear it.
Okay.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back. And I have in the studio with me Rick Rhodes, and we've been talking about his book, They Made America Great, 31 Endearing Legacies Worth Heeding. And we've been particularly talking about Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. And so I thought it would be so appropriate to have my next guest. Stephen Harrigan was on the program before. I just love his book. It's called A Friend of Mr. Lincoln, and I'm so happy to welcome you back, Steve.
Thank you, Patsy. It's great to be back.
Well, you know, I've been thinking, you know, all month about president and, you know, the whole history of presidents. And when I was looking around at my books, as I mentioned in my email to you, I just stopped at your book, A Friend of Mr. Lincoln, and I just had to pull it out again and sit down. And just, I mean, that first chapter is so gripping that anybody who reads this book will just, they'll be in awe of your work.
Oh, thank you.
You know, it starts off at President Lincoln's funeral. And although I've read so many books about Lincoln, nobody captures that moment like you do.
Well, thank you very much. I was, you know, that was my goal, was to try to, even though it's a work of fiction, I mean, that's kind of the vehicle that I wanted to use to try to get readers into the room, essentially, to make people feel that, you know, or at least create the illusion that this is what it was like in Springfield, Illinois at that time. You know, I'm really glad to think that you thought I succeeded.
Oh, you did. Well, of course, I have to remind everyone that you are, well, you're a brilliant, brilliant writer in general. I also have a special soft spot for you because you also write screenplays and scripts. And, you know, because I used to write scripts, I always admire somebody who can do both. And you're just terrific, and I was thinking about you recently. Anyway, because about Texas, I was going to have you invite you on to talk about the Gates of the Alamo, which is, I think, one of the greatest books ever. It's an amazing book. The Alamo, the whole thing. You have an ability to really take the reader into the locations that you write about and make us feel like we're there. So I'm going to have you back just to talk about that book one day. But, you know, I woke up this morning because, you know, we're going to talk about Lincoln. And so on the news, everywhere on the news, they were talking about this statue of President Lincoln. And so it reminded me that, you know, so many people don't understand really his real importance.
Mm-hmm. I think he's obviously crucially important in the history of this country. It's you know, hard to even begin to kind of calculate the ways in which, you know, he had a kind of defining impact on where we ended up as a country, and you know, in many ways where we still aspire to go. I was struck. What I was determined to do in this book was try to strip away all the kind of hagiography and you know, latter day, you know, esteem that we hold for him, or at least many people in the country do, and to try to understand what he was like as a real human being. And I kind of zeroed in on the period of his life when he was young and striving and confused and maybe overly ambitious and maybe kind of underdeveloped as a personality yet. And so that was what really, you know, when you talk about, you know, when you very kindly say that I, you know, make this kind of stuff vivid for the reader, it's because, you know, I was looking for the flaws in Lincoln as much as the, you know, as the virtues. And, I think without those flaws and without those complications, he's not understandable as a as probably our most important president.
Exactly, you know, your book puts all these layers on him, so we understand what he had to overcome himself, and I of course the way you did it by concentrating on Cage Weatherby,
right? Uh-huh.
And just taking this friend and seeing Lincoln through his eyes. And of course, as I said, the book starts in 1865, the death of Lincoln. And then quickly, once you've sort of set us in that spot where we really start understanding the era, you take us back quite a few years to 1832, where you just start giving us layer after layer of Lincoln, and it works beautifully.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was really exhilarating for me to think about and do some research, you know, quite a bit of research about what his life must have been like at that time, and again how young he was and how raw and unformed and ambitious, and you know, he wasn't. What really drove me in writing this book was that the idea that Lincoln was just a guy, you know, he was just one of us for a long time, and was just striving to better himself and make a living and get married and do all the ordinary things, not just the extraordinary things that he ended up doing.
Well, I mentioned I have in the studio with me Rick Rhodes, and we were just talking about Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass was also, he was always striving, right, Rick?
Yes, he was. And what Frederick Douglass one thing said about Lincoln, he said, the difference between him and I is nothing but the color of our skin. Frederick Douglass.
Right.
Exactly. That there is greatness in all of us, and you just have to keep striving. You have to keep learning and keep trying to do better and to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that the Lincoln, I mean, you know, there were dark parts of Lincoln in a way, but the thing that redeemed him as a human being and that I think, you know, helped redeem this country was the fact that he had this idea of what he wanted to be, this idea of honor that was so commanding in his life and his personality. And when he failed to live up to that, he collapsed. He fell apart. I mean, he was suicidal and fell into deep, dark depressions because he didn't believe that he believed that he had fallen short of what he could be. And those are the kind of people who, you know, who I think end up making a difference because they've got a kind of moral compass and they're not always at true north, but they're trying.
Well, tell us about that period from 1832. Tell us a little bit more about the Lincoln that you discovered. Of course, you had to do, you know, there are so many books about Lincoln. And I think that what you've managed to do here is to really, as I said, bring him to life in a way that so many other books have failed.
Well, I think a lot of books have succeeded in making us understand who Lincoln was, what he represented, what he had struggled through, and what he achieved. And, you know, those books were absolutely essential to me, and I read, you know, almost every Lincoln biography and all the sort of arcana that has been produced about Lincoln, you know, through the last century and a half or so. But I never found anything that made me, as a reader, feel like I was completely experiencing what it was like to live, you know, in Lincoln's world. And there are great books about Lincoln. I mean, one of the books that really was most helpful to me was a book called Honor's Voice by Douglas Wilson, which really delves deep into this formative period of Lincoln's life and lays out all the complexities and confusion that he was experiencing at that time. And so I took those, you know, my goal, my charge to myself was to be as historically accurate as I could possibly be as a novelist, and to sort of burrow deep into the awareness and consciousness of that time and try to make it feel real. And to do that, I decided that I needed a fictional lens through which to look at this. So I created my own character who I kind of posited was Lincoln's best friend during this time, and somebody who, like Lincoln, his name is Cage Weatherby, Macajo Weatherby, and like Lincoln, he is striving, he is ambitious, he is determined to make a mark, you know, to go down in history as something, and in his case, he wants to be a poet. And Lincoln also aspired to be a poet, and actually wrote some pretty good poems. And he belonged to a poetry society in Springfield, Illinois, when he was a young man. And so I have them meeting. Well, they meet in the Black Hawk War, and then they re-meet in the poetry society, and they become best friends. And through the lens of this character, I felt I could observe Lincoln as a real three-dimensional human being, as a friend who is sometimes failing in to meet the standards of Cage Weatherby and sometimes surpassing what his expectations are.
Well, so tell us a little bit about Springfield at that time.
Well, it was the place you wanted to be if you were in Illinois or in that area. It was the brand new state capital of Illinois. They were building the Capitol building. Everybody was sort of flocking there to make a name for themselves, to get into business, to be become a politician, to be somebody. And I think that it was a hive of ambition, you know. And Lincoln, who grew up a lot in New Salem, which is only 20 miles away, was of course inexorably drawn to the opportunities available there. He went there to study law. He became a lawyer there. He became a member of the General Assembly, the state legislature, and I think that was where his ambition to be something really important, somebody who could make a mark was established.
Now,
it's really interesting when you go to Springfield today. I don't know if you or Mr. Rhodes have been there recently, but it's so clear what that place was like. The street names are the same. The layout is essentially the same. You can go to Lincoln's house, and you can see the nail holes in the mantle where he and his children used to hang their Christmas stockings. It's just so it's eerily present, and you can imagine walking down the street and coming across Abraham Lincoln walking in the other direction.
And it is really quite amazing place to be. Have you been there yet, Rick?
No, Bardstown, Illinois, but not Springfield.
Oh, you have to go there.
Oh, you got to go. It's wonderful.
It is. And the thing is, there was a diverse mix of people there. They were Lincoln got to know quite a few different types of people in Springfield.
Oh yeah, right. And I mean, that was his business. He was a politician, and he was also a lawyer, and so he got to know them. He got to know people by either representing them or suing them or you know, representing them and then suing the same people. He was he was very much a part of the mix of Springfield. And of course there were people like Mary Todd who arrived in Springfield looking for a husband and managed in the term of the time to enter into an embrigglement with Abraham Lincoln, which was a very complex dating situation that ended up, of course, with their marriage, with a very troubled marriage, but in some ways a very fulfilling one, I think.
And of course, you mentioned it quite a bit in the book. I think some aspects that we didn't know. And again, this is what makes your book so fascinating.
Well, basically at the heart of this, it's kind of a romantic comedy, about Lincoln's courtship of Mary Todd, and how that kind of went all askew in various ways, including ending up in a duel that almost happened between Lincoln and a guy named James Shields, it's not a rom-com really, but it is a kind of, there are a lot of it's kind of a comedy of errors in the sense that Lincoln keeps stumbling over himself, making big mistakes all the way through, slandering people in the newspaper, which leads to this attempted duel or aborted duel. So these are characters that I think, again, people can identify with because they're making mistakes, and they're desperately trying to be something or do something, and then there are problems and obstacles in their way.
Now, when you did a lot of research on this, right?
I mean, you kind of have to because you have to know. The kind of external reality of what happened. Then you have to, when you're writing an historical novel, you're your own like costume designer and production designer. you've got to know what the wallpaper looked like. You've got to know what people were eating. You have to know what they were wearing. You have to know how they spoke. And so that's, I would talk to various experts or read books about recipe books from the 1840s to try to, again, put people in the room and give them a sense of what life was like then.
Would you like to comment on his relationship with Ann Rutledge?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that is kind of mentioned briefly in the book. My book starts later than that, but Ann Rutledge was his first true love, and maybe only true love in some senses. She lived in New Salem, where Lincoln lived, and died at a very young age, and it almost destroyed Lincoln. I mean, there were two periods in his life where he fell into a flat-out and potentially suicidal depression, and the death of Ann Rutledge was one of them. And that, I think he kind of carried that trauma and tragedy throughout the rest of his life.
Well, you know, I think what you've done with this book is great, and I don't know, have they picked it up yet for television?
No, hasn't happened yet. I mean, there was Spielberg's Lincoln movie, which I think took a lot of the air out of the room in terms of
well, I think this story is it has an intimacy, and as it is about this particular period where you're really revealing Lincoln in a way that people haven't seen. I like that you know, most people never think of Lincoln as a poet, for example. And
right,
I think that's something important to know about him. And I wish more people would, you know, sometimes they think, oh, well, who writes poetry? But if somebody understands, sometimes I think particularly men will say, oh, well, you know, maybe poetry isn't for me. But if they know that Abraham Lincoln wrote poetry, maybe they'll try it, because there's so much that you can say in poetry. And it just makes him human and makes him somebody that you can relate to. And I hope they pick it up. I think I've been, I watched the, of course, the John Adams, and I thought about this book. Well, of course, I'm hoping for the Alamo book. I know they've done movies about the Alamo, but your take on it is so very, very good that, you know, there's a desperate need for some good material out there. But in your case, of course, you could actually write the script, because you are a heck of a screenwriter, too.
Well, thank you, yeah. I've always thought Adam Driver would be a great young Lincoln.
Ah, wow.
You know, he's tall, and he's got a kind of raw-boned look, and, you know, I think he would be really good for if this was ever a movie or a TV limited series or something. He would be perfect for it. Casting has a lot to do with this kind of thing, and but he's got a Lincoln-esque quality to me, you know. And it's hard to find somebody who's the right, you know, the right size, the right age, the right look.
Well, you know, I was talking to Lee Child when he was here recently,
uh-huh.
And he was here in St. Petersburg. And, of course, Lee Child, you know, he's going to get the next, I think he's going to select the next Jack Reacher. Who, of course, you know, he wrote Jack Reacher's 6'6", blonde, blue-eyed,
right.
And...
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And handsome, not, you know, of course, and which is what he is.
Right.
And so he had not envisioned it as Tom Cruise. I think the next Jack Reacher is going to be more like Lee himself. And
right.
it is important that you have the right look. But I'm really looking forward to seeing it. And, you know, they've got streaming video now, they're doing all sorts of stuff and all of these things, and I really hope that they pick this up, because it would, what I like are all the little things in it, whether it's a scene in the hotel where it's just all these little things that you have that would be so great to have in a film.
Well, okay, well, I'll let you try to talk someone into picking this up, Patrick.
Okay.
It would be, yeah, I think it could be a really good, probably a, you know, 6-hour series or something like that.
That's what I think. That's, you know, somebody who, I think in terms of scripts, as a matter of fact, when I first started the book, the first section, I mean, mm-hmm. I sat there, I read it once, I saw the whole thing in my head immediately, exactly how I would do it, how it should be shot. I knew the camera angles. I knew it. You know, I'm like, so I had to stop myself before I continued to the 1832 section. And I went back and I read it again, and I said, can this be so good? I mean, it's like a dream beginning of a film. And I read it three times, actually, before I went on to the rest of the book, because I said, well, this guy is one great writer, that he can just create that atmosphere and the scene, and the visualization of it is so perfect. So I'm really, really, I'm looking forward to it. And I'd fight you to write the screenplay, but I know that they'll take you. But if they need some... Somebody,
well, maybe we can collaborate. You're already pretty far down the road.
Oh, I am. I could do it. Sometimes I get a book where I get into the book and I start feeling like I'm walking along with the characters. And you did this by writing it from the friend's point of view. I think that's what really makes it come alive. We sort of step into Cage's shoes. And we're walking along with him and seeing it through his eyes. And I think it's perfect.
Oh, well I really appreciate what you had to say. I appreciate how deep you've gone into the cinematic version of it.
Okay.
Could be pretty interesting.
Well, the minute you get a deal, you have to promise to come back on and tell us about it, okay?
Absolutely.
And meanwhile, I'm going to look and find a spot for you so we can spend a whole hour talking about the Alamo book, okay?
Oh, I'd love to do that with
because
you.
Because I love that book. Again, you are an amazing writer, just one of the best. And I really appreciate that you came on today, because today I think it's important that this month we think about Lincoln and think about Black History Month and about all of the things that have gone on in this country and how great people like Lincoln, like Frederick Douglass, like Harriet Tubman can do wonders and make this country great.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you, Rick Rhodes, for being part of the conversation.
And thank you.
Okay. Well, I'll be in contact. So
okay.
Again,
all
Steve.
Right. Well, it was great talking to both of you, and thank you, Patsy.
Okay. Bye bye now. Bye.
Okay. Bye bye.
Isn't he great?
He is wonderful. It is.
You have to read this book. I just tell you. It does exactly do that. It reads like a movie, and you get in it, and you start. As I said, because I've also read many books. I have maybe 20 books about Lincoln, and of all the books, when I started this one, I was there. I was in the place.
That is amazing. Lincoln is, without a doubt, my favorite American too. I mean, I didn't put him in my book because everybody should know everything about him. I just deliberately left them out. I did, but you're right. We really don't appreciate him as much as we really should.
Exactly. You know? So this is a wonderful thing, and I'm so glad that the name of the book is A Friend of Mr. Lincoln. It's by Stephen Harrigan. It's I think the paperback version just came out recently, but it's a wonderful book, well worth your time, and just something that will change your sort of idea. I love this about the poetry. And this is just something that makes you feel more in touch with Lincoln, the man.
I agree.
And I think everyone will enjoy it. And it's, of course, available wherever books are sold. And your book is available, too. Well, Rick, you know, writing a book is not easy. And I really admire what you've done here in all this research that you put into They Made America Great. And you've picked 31 people that I think, as I said, there were a few that I didn't know about. And I think, I don't know, one of the ways that you're promoting this book, there's, you know, it's difficult always for an author who's published independently to get out there and to get the book out. I know you just started recently on Facebook.
That's right.
And you have to start that. But I had not thought about it in terms the way my son did when he picked up the book and he said, trivia. Trivia is a big, big thing in America today. Kids are playing it. I mean, college kids are playing it. And all the time, it's a way for them to get together and they learn, and also there a lot of them are watching Jeopardy. They they watch it and they like it. And so having your book where you have 31 different people, that's, you know, you never know. Yeah. So perhaps you have to do a little trivia game with this.
That's a thought. I've never thought of that angle. I kind of look at myself as a distiller. I read 100 books to put, at least 100 books to put this thing together, and I try to pick out and write it very simplistically, eighth grade, maybe lower high school level. And I just say, okay, Ben Franklin learned to teach himself how to swim by reading a book. How many people really know that?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, you were telling me that story. When we learn these things about people, it makes us want to know more.
I hope, yes.
So, yeah, so I mentioned to you about the series Monk, where Monk learns how to swim by, correspondence course. So just a few other people. Mention a few other people in your book.
Well, I in Black History Month, one of the local fellows here is Vivian Thomas. His uncle, or his nephew, excuse me, operated on my knee. He's the orthopedic surgeon at Tampa Bay Rays. He cured, along with a doctor in Nashville, basically cured blue baby syndrome. I'm old enough to remember that era. You probably are too, where a lot of babies died because
Kennedy and Jackie's baby.
They didn't get enough blood to their lungs, and as he was not even a doctor, he wanted to become a doctor, and he could have in Nashville, Tennessee, and he worked in Vanderbilt, and he basically worked over the shoulder of this other very famous doctor. They did a couple other things like shock in World War II and stuff like that, and they cured blue baby syndrome. Another, Vivian Thomas, Google him. There's a great show on PBS about him. Another one I like is George Washington Carver.
I love George Washington Carver. So you have other ways to promote your book. There are sort of, sometimes you have to do untraditional things. When you do Facebook, one of the things is you can link on to people who are interested in trivia.
Mm-hmm.
There
That's
are
a good point.
Millions of people interested in trivia. And if you do that, you're going to get people following you. And this is one of the things, I'm talking to people all the time. I want to just remind all of you before the show ends, the deadline for the Writer's Digest contest, self-published contest, is April 1st. You please, please go and enter that. Rick, I want to thank you so much for being in today.
Thank you,
and
Patsy.
I'm going to have you back. We'll select a few more people, and you'll come in, we'll talk about it. It's lots of fun to talk to you. Because remember, everyone, one of the things I tell you, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you are really, really lucky, to have those wonderful words said out loud, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a film or a television series or maybe streaming video. Nowadays, everything is streaming all over the place. You never know. All you have to do is start writing. Just start writing, and who knows, you might just hit it, right?
I hope, yeah. If nothing else, you want to help people and tell them about our country.
That's it. Well, that's great. And I just want to thank Big Ed in the control room. Ed, thank you so much. He's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. And everybody, have a great day. Bye-bye now.